For Women's History Month, here is a panel comprised of their members describing risks women journalists have faced for speaking truth to power.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Speaking Truth to Power was the theme of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television Conference held in Delhi, India in the fall of 2015. One panel there featured courageous women journalists who fight censorship in their own countries. Wings invited an Amsterdam-based radio producer and activist for women journalists to select excerpts from that event and put them in global context. Here's Mindy Ran.
Attacks on foreign correspondents may make world headlines, but recent research shows it's much more dangerous to be a local journalist who covers corrupt, repressive governments, criminal gangs, or big money interests. All the women you are about to hear take those kinds of risks. Their countries are officially democracies. They have constitutions and hold elections. They have both state and private media. But like a growing number of countries around the world, they also use threats and violence for media control.
We have currently more than 500 political prisoners in the country, and roughly half of them are women.
This is Ilang Ilang Quijano from the Philippines. She's the managing director and editor of a multimedia outlet for investigative journalism, Pinoy Weekly. She showed slides.
That's Sharon Cabusao. She was an officer of Gabriela, the women's movement in the Philippines. And she was our editor. And at the time of her arrest, she was also a researcher for a labor group. She's still under custody, even if they arrested her without warrant. She and her husband are detained in that small cell. It's really like a cell for dogs, you know. Another woman political prisoner, she's Andrea Rosal. She is the daughter of the late communist spokesperson. So they arrested her and they accused her of being a rebel, but her case was dismissed because they found no evidence. But what was the price? When she was arrested, she was pregnant. And then she gave birth in custody, but they didn't give her any medical attention. And what happened was her baby died. So really, it's worse than martial law, because in martial law, the older people tell us that, you know, in martial law, the women, they were always freed, you know, because of humanitarian reasons, especially pregnant women.
The vulnerability of prisoners who are mothers is exemplified by Turkish journalist Arzu Yildiz. In May 2016, she was sentenced to 20 months in prison for reporting on alleged Turkish arms shipments to Syria. The court also stripped her of her parental rights. As of August 2016, 68 journalists are imprisoned in Turkey. China, Egypt, Eritrea, and Syria are among the current hotspots for arrests of journalists and bloggers. Death is the ultimate form of silencing. One of many women journalists killed in the Philippines was Melinda Magsino.
This is an interesting case because she was a former journalist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. She was exposing the gambling activities of the governor of Batangas, the province she lives in. And in 2005, she went into hiding because of death threats. And then she retired from journalism. And then she got killed this year. They say that it's still because of the exposés that she did when she was a print journalist. And then when she was no longer a journalist, she continued exposing these through social media. The state forces usually try to deny that the killing is related to their work as a journalist. And they say that, oh, maybe it was because of a love angle, because she now has a new husband. For women, it's very difficult to be recognized as a journalist, even if you are killed, you know?
The worst massacre of journalists recorded to date was in the Philippines.
In the Ampatuan case, 58 people were killed, 32 of them were journalists. Some were human rights lawyers, others were civilians. The major perpetrator of the crime, it's like a warlord clan. One of them was already released on bail. And then 41 other police officers accused of the crime were released on bail. About 80 plus still remain at large. There are a total of 94 persons who were involved in the crime. And then witnesses. There have been 4 to 5 witnesses who have already been killed. The worst thing is the army officials who were involved in the massacre were promoted.
According to the International Federation of Journalists, over 2,200 journalists and media staff were killed between 1990 and 2016, 48 of them in the first half of 2016. In most cases, like the massacre in the Philippines, the vast majority of perpetrators have never been brought to trial.
It is very unfortunate in the Philippines that the killings of journalists continue under the current administration. And since 1986, there are like 174 journalists who have already been killed. So in 2013, the Philippines was ranked as the second most dangerous country for journalists, only next to Iraq. Since 1986, there have only been 11 convictions. Out of the 174 killings, only 11 convictions. And these are only the trigger men. No masterminds have ever been convicted.
That was Ilong Ilong Quijano, speaking on a panel of women journalists in September 2015. In June 2016, the incoming president of the Philippines was asked about the 176 journalists killed since his party came to power in 1986. He replied that many of them deserved to die. He went on to say, "The Constitution can't help you if you disrespect a person." Like the Philippines, the island country of Sri Lanka has ongoing ethnic and political conflicts. Their 25-year civil war officially ended in 2009, but the next government continued the power struggle through brutal media suppression.
The law seems to be of relevance to Sri Lanka, actually, for the last 5 years or so. Instead, what we had was complete and utter annihilation of the media.
Sri Lankan lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena.
The scores of killings in the northern and the eastern peninsula where the war actually took place has been legion. We have had censorship really being conformed from a matter of the law. The whole discussion and the whole struggle got transformed from that to a method of outright killings. And that transformation makes the very issue of censorship actually quite redundant. Because what do you do when, you know, your colleagues are killed? The pervasive fear that this leads to then chills every voice in the land. And I must also stress here the role played by the law in this regard. What happened was we had a whole plethora of military law, emergency law, Prevention of Terrorism Act, which was used to completely harass, intimidate, and censor journalists across the board. So at a point, you know, the military could walk into a printing press or into a publication house and just take over the entire house, take over the printing press. And nobody could challenge this in courts because the courts itself became an appendage of the political control and the political establishment. Courts also lost their independence. What was the point of my continuing in the country? It got to be so bad.
After the war ended, the president of Sri Lanka forbade investigation of war crimes and tightened his control on the media.
Pursuant to the ending of the conflict, Sri Lanka became worse. Because at least earlier we had the so-called excuse of a conflict to explain why the media was being censored or controlled. But pursuant to 2009, what happened was we had one political family controlling the entire government and controlling the entire working of the state apparatus in Sri Lanka, the Rajapaksas. The one brother was the president, all-powerful executive president. The other brother was the all-powerful secretary of defense. The other brother was the speaker of parliament. And we had scores of other relatives and cousins and whoever, you know, unknown of, unheard of people, you know, being heading all kinds of state and institutional mechanisms. And to put this in context, this was really quite unprecedented for Sri Lanka because we had had very long traditions of democracy, despite the fact that we had long-standing conflict in the country. We were not used to this kind of family aggrandizement, as it were. As a result of this transformation of the power of government, the media itself became more and more apathetic and less independent. So the state media, on the one hand, was completely taken over by the government, and we had propaganda to the extent that it was unimaginable, the state propaganda that took place. And the private media was also bought over by the Rajapaksa brothers. If you compare what the Indian media is and you compare the Sri Lankan media, you compare the Philippines media and you compare the Sri Lankan media. Sri Lanka is such a small country, you know. So when you have this corporate political control extending to almost every reach of the private media, you know, the extent to which the media collapsed in terms of its independence was enormous. On the one hand, we had this oppressive nature of the law, and then we had the method of killings and intimidation and complete fear being used by the government to censor and to threaten and control the media. And the self-censorship that took place was extremely high. There were, of course, exceptions to this rule. It was actually a joke during the repressive years that the voices speaking out against the government were really mostly women. It became quite interesting and quite amusing at a point that women commentators were actually being hailed as the people having the balls, so as to speak, in Sri Lanka. But though this picture was there of dominant female voices speaking out, in general, the control of the media was very much elite male dominated. The presence of women, though they are in numbers, were not there in the managerial and editorial positions that one would expect. And in a sense, that lack of women editorial control was very well seen in the newsrooms and is still seen and has been the case for the last 3-4 decades, as it were.
One of the promises of the new government Sri Lanka elected in 2015 was that it would lift the bans that had been imposed against social media, especially websites of the Tamil minority. Bans on social media had not been effective in any case, as Jay Wardena explains.
We have had social media being used very effectively against the government during the last 5 years when the mainstream media could not function. In fact, social media was the reason why the Rajapaksa government was overthrown in January 2015, and also in August last month, when after years of going through this absolute terror, the Sri Lankan people overthrew this particular political family and brought in another government into power. And social media was a huge voice in that regard, but women again here did not play as prominent or as predominant a role as in the Philippines.
You are listening to lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena. She and other activists succeeded in getting a right to information law passed in Sri Lanka, and the previous government's website bans lifted. At the time she spoke to the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, she was skeptical that the new government of Sri Lanka would live up to its promises of media freedom. And indeed, since then, a requirement to register websites has been imposed. But she says it's not only up to the government to reform Sri Lankan media.
One of the most challenging tasks for us is to go beyond the law to see what is really wrong with us, with the media in its functioning and in its control. We have had a situation where an entire minority has been categorized as being second-class citizens in Sri Lanka by the media itself. The racism and the communalism prevalent on the part of the mainstream media has been astounding. We need to look inwards at the media and not look only at the state as a reason or as the fount or the origin of censorship.
On Wings, you're listening to voices recorded in Delhi, India, at the 36th Biennial Conference of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. The theme of the conference was Speaking Truth to Power. Here again is producer and activist for women journalists, Mindy Ran.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, there were 232 journalists jailed around the world in 2012. More than half of them were sentenced under anti-terrorist laws. Continued expansion of these laws creates convenient cover for punishing journalists and forcing them to reveal their sources. But older laws are also getting brought back into play against journalists. Among these are libel, defined as a published false statement that is damaging to a person's reputation, and also sedition, which was defined in the 19th century as conduct or language inciting rebellion against a lawful government. Colonial-era sedition and seditious libel laws are still being used against journalists and netizens in India, Tanzania, Nigeria, Malaysia, and other former colonies of Britain and France. These kinds of charges can easily be corrupted to try and block criticisms of officials and companies, and they are very difficult to fight. Ilang Ilang Quijano, her father, and four other journalists were charged with criminal libel in 2004. It took them 12 years to beat the charge. Quijano's father is a physician and a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of the Philippines. His research had shown that pesticides used on bananas were poisoning workers. Ilang Ilang Quijano.
I was not arrested. I turned myself in for bail because they tried to arrest my father. Me and then the editors of the paper, we paid 10,000 pesos for bail. And not many people have that kind of money. And we never got the bail back, you know, even if the charges were dismissed. And the case dragged on for 12 years. And we spent around 500,000 pesos defending ourselves for what was obviously a harassment case by a plantation. Because the evidence is very clear, you know, health poisoning, the people were getting sick, the environment was getting destroyed, and we had pictures, we had interviews, it was very well documented. And yet, the case dragged on for 12 years. It was actually dismissed by the lower court, but the owner of the company was a minister, agriculture minister, and during his time, he had the ruling reversed. It drained our resources. Of course, there are many NGOs helping us, but even ordinary citizens or journalists are sued with libel. I wonder how can they cope with such harassment suits. In the Philippines, it's really used to harass. And then the worst thing that happened is that instead of decriminalizing libel, they actually added another form, which is online libel. The funny thing is, they call it the Cybercrime Prevention Act. And originally, it was supposed to penalize crimes that had to do with things like protecting women's and children's rights. And the thing is, it was passed without public consultation. So from before, it was 6 months, the minimum. Now it's like 6 years, and the maximum is 12 years of imprisonment.
Quijano gave examples of how the new law was abused.
See this woman in my picture. She's a teacher who just posted on social media about the mining companies, Taiwanese and Chinese mining companies, whom the mayor was involved with, and the mayor sued her, and she got detained overnight. Some nurses in Taguig who were complaining about how the hospital was being run, they were fired from their jobs. Liking a libelous post or in sharing a libelous post on Facebook means that you're aiding and abetting the crime. And they even had a takedown clause wherein if the Department of Justice sees reasonable cause for the website to be shut down, that was the takedown provision. And also it allowed for the collection of real-time data, metadata. But these clauses, these really draconian, you know, clauses, they were struck down by the Supreme Court. So that was an initial victory. And it's only because that people, the media, they really fought.
Quijano is one of the new generation of journalists who are creating their own multimedia outlets online.
We are the ones who would be the primary victims of this law because we believe that the repression of the medium is the message.
Women speaking out online whether as journalists, bloggers, or activists, often experience abuse by trolls. Dr. Anya Kovacs directs the Internet Democracy Project in Delhi, India.
There was a case very recently of a woman called Preeta PG, who has about 17,000 followers on Facebook. She's from Kerala, a South Indian state, and she writes a lot about political issues. Sometime in July, she made some comments criticizing a Kerala politician for sexist comments he had been making. As a consequence, faced a lot of abuse. Her profile was temporarily taken down by Facebook. She managed to get that restored. Once it was restored, the former president of India, Dr. Kalam, died, who she then criticized again on Facebook, again became the victim of massive hate. There were hate pages created just to attack her. There was a page created to claim that she was a prostitute. Her son is disabled and was pulled into this as well. There were a whole number of women who responded, so she got quite a lot of online support against all of this. But about a week later, the hate pages were still on. Preeta's own page was taken down, and the profiles of a lot of the women who supported her were taken down as well. Aspects about this incident say a lot about the landscape of free speech in general. First of all is the way in which mob violence or social pressure groups can actually impose censorship without even having to use the law. It was very clear that the people who attacked Preeta did so on political grounds, and that that was why she was silenced. The second thing is that the law and police often doesn't really help. Yesterday, I came to know about journalists of Khabar Lahariya, which is a rural newspaper from Uttar Pradesh, run by marginalized women, that they have been harassed on mobile phone by a stalker for about 2 months now, with multiple calls from different numbers on a daily basis. And the only thing that the police did was pass around the phone in the police station so that different policemen could talk to the abuser and basically have a joke. And the third issue is about the response of Facebook as an internet intermediary, one of the companies that actually controls a lot of these spaces. Interesting in Preeta's case is that she was not writing in English. She was writing in Malayali, a language that most people in Kerala speak, and which also has a different script. Facebook claims to have community moderators, but clearly they didn't find what was going on the hate pages problematic in any way. Preeta was told that this does not violate community standards. Facebook said, because it does not come under international hate speech regulation, we cannot take it down. So the community standards basically became international law, which sees hate speech as being based on religion, nationality, and ethnic background, right? But doesn't recognize neither gender, nor disability, nor sexual orientation. Facebook refused to create a safe space for Preeta, but the profiles of Preeta and her friends were all taken down on the grounds that they did not use their real name. Preeta's last name that's on her birth certificate is not PG, it's a caste name. Using your caste name can have wider ramifications for political activists from lower castes in particular, which you do not necessarily want to face. Preeta has been in touch with Facebook, and after a lot of discussing, her profile has now been restored. She doesn't have to use her caste name for now. But the whole case raises really important questions about who Facebook will hear. The women started a campaign, so there's a hashtag for a better Facebook, both on Facebook and on Twitter, to highlight how Facebook restricts women's speech on purely commercial grounds because it's easier for them to sell advertisements if they can profile you across many different platforms. It was really interesting to see how in no time, women from across South Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East, started to say exactly the same thing. Facebook has been hearing voices from women of the West to some extent and responded to some of the issues that they face. But even in Western countries, trans women face issues with the real name policy Native American women had been facing issues because their names were not recognized as real names by the Facebook community keepers.
One of the experiences we've had in Kenya is that when women feel violated online, instead of fighting back for their space, they actually get off the online spaces.
Rachel Nakatari, past president of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV.
One of the things we had to do was to train the police, but the police themselves are not sensitized. In fact, in Kenya, for example, we do not have very specific laws that address issues of cybersecurity. And so even when you report to the police, they're helpless. So one of the things that we have actually tried to do is to partner with the police now and get experts to train them. Because when we try to have an interview with the internet service providers, the Google, they say their allegiance is first to the customer, say they do not want to deal with the activists. They want to protect the people, you know, who are then abusing you online. So it becomes very tricky. And one of the biggest challenges that we've had is how do we deal with the borderlessness of the internet and also the anonymity, because the anonymous nature, like where we were using pseudonyms, in the Kenyan case where we've seen and where we have some examples is that when you attack the people in power and go online using pseudonyms or anonymity, then they also clear you without letting anybody know that they've done that. And we've actually lost some bloggers. Up to today, we don't know where they went. So they use the same anonymous nature of your posting against you by then clearing you without anybody knowing where you've gone to.
Sheila Dallas Katzman is the president of the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV. She thinks in terms of both inside and outside strategies.
You can talk to Facebook. IWRT has three representatives at the United Nations, and the late Catherine D. White, rest her soul, was able to bring Facebook, Twitter, Google, and have them train civil society organizations on the use of these social media platforms. So, we could invite Facebook representatives or whomever, and they will come. So, it's not that we can't get them. We must invite them and discuss with them what these problems are, because they don't even understand cultures. Look at Twitter. In Thailand, the names are so long that it's so difficult for people in Thailand to put out Twitter messages. And I want to ask you this. Do you think we can boycott Facebook? Do you think we should do that as women? Let's do that. Let's call for a day of action and shut it down for a day. Women across the world, we can do that.
For more about the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, visit the website iawrt.org. In Amsterdam, I'm Mindy Rann.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Her Turn will be back next week with more feminist news and information. Thanks for listening. WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Jessica Ackerley with Tim Daisy and Josh Berman on Saturday, March 23rd, 8 p.m. at Audio for the Arts. Jessica Ackerley is a Canadian guitarist, improviser, and composer based in Honolulu. Ackerley draws on the influences of Black American music and avant-garde improvisers, as well as the culture of the thriving New York City rock and noise scenes. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org. WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. This is your host, Miss Nikki, because it's the third Sunday of the month. Get ready for her infinite variety.